Hello, everyone, and welcome to NSPS Radio Hour. I'm pleased today to have Dick Elgin with me. Dick is a friend for quite some time now, and I'm sure a lot of our audience is going to recognize his name. He's quite prominent in the surveying world. And today we're going to talk specifically about his, is this an obsession or a habit or what is it, Dick?
Well, the collectors out there will recognize the pattern. You know, we pack rats, we begin with kind of an interest in something, and then the interest kind of evolves into a bit of an avocation sometimes, and sometimes it develops into a business, and then pretty soon it gets on, and the avocation becomes an obsession, and then pretty soon it's just all. It's all encompassing. So, depending on your collecting level, all collectors would be guilty of one of those phases. For me, it was quite an obsession, and has been for many years, both collecting and researching these early American makers.
You know, and it seems to me, as I travel about and visit with folks around the country, that it's more commonplace than one might expect for the people who are involved in collection at some level, not necessarily at the same level, but it is interesting to me how many people have an interest in this.
Well, we surveyors, of course, we're part detectives, we're mostly measurers, and we're also historians. And every retracement surveyor has a bit of a historian in themselves, and so we historians, you know, it's natural to start collecting. Of course, over the years, we surveyors have used many different kinds of equipment. So there's lots of collectible items out there, and it's nice to see some compass or a chain or some old surveying device on just about every surveyor's desk.
Yeah, years ago, you know, David Ingram.
Oh yes,
David was tied up with the Surveyors Museum in those days, and there was some show up in Pennsylvania somewhere, a big auction, and he couldn't go. So he sent me up there to purchase one of two or both particular things he was looking for. And I'm pretty glad he told me what he was looking for specifically, because I didn't have enough knowledge to know what was good and what wasn't good, but I was amazed at the amount of product that was there.
Yeah. What's happened over the years, of course, you know, as some of we older surveyors fade, it's typical. Quite often you run across collections or small collections, or an estate will have pieces a surveyor had. And so there's a lot of equipment out there. The other thing that's happened is eBay has brought to the marketplace a lot of equipment. You know, for the more collectible devices, you know, we serious collectors used to think that, oh, there was kind of a limited number of those compasses or whatever out there. But with eBay's and auction and Antiques Roadshow kind of making it so popular, a lot of collectible equipment has kind of come out of the woodwork over the last decade or so.
Right. Well, maybe we've talked about the basic topic we're going to discuss today and giving our audience some thought about that, but maybe it'd be a really good idea to let them get to know you better, and I'm pretty sure as soon as you start talking about this, they're going to say, okay, that's where the obsession comes from.
Well, I'm a second generation surveyor. My late father before me was a pack rat and a collector, as I mentioned a lot of folks are. He actually started the collection in old 1950s or so, when stuff was cheap. And so I followed in my father's footsteps, and of course worked with him as a youngster. And like a lot of others out there, after working for my father in high school, there was one thing I was not going to be when I went on in life, and that was to be a surveyor. But as a lot of the listeners will know, once you're infected with surveying, there's no known cure. You're forever going to be a surveyor. I was going to go be the world's greatest engineer, but of course, being infected, that didn't work, and so I went to be a surveyor. But my collecting background begins with my parents. They were both pack rats. One of their kind of rules in life was that all the wee kids had to collect something. It didn't matter what, but at a young age, we were all expected to collect something. And, of course, surveying equipment became my collectible, but my siblings likewise have collections of other things, not surveying equipment. So I got started at quite some years ago and have kept at it ever since. And now the collection is fairly well inventoried, but now we're, it's about 600 items, some small, but some larger, relatively valuable and interesting and historic pieces. But it's at about 600 pieces or so now.
So your route to get to being part of serving, and I'm asking this question because I always say in these types of instances, we all say we're not going to follow in our father's footsteps. Mine was a minister, and I didn't follow in his footsteps, obviously. I chose surveying. I always say it's because it gave me an opportunity to help people but not do it in the same way he did. So you obviously looked at surveying, and did you tailor your education in that direction initially, or had you started the education headed toward that engineering side?
Yeah. No, I started towards engineering. Got my B.S. in civil, and then went out and worked in consulting engineering, and then got my M.S. in civil engineering. But even in those, working for a consulting engineering company, I did mostly surveying. At that time, I was working in the Kansas City area. Of course, today I live in Rolla, Missouri, where the Missouri University of Science and Technology is essentially the engineering campus of the University of Missouri system. And my parents lived nearby, and so I wanted to get back to Rolla into academics. And so I went to the University of Arkansas, and under Dave Knowles down there, got my Ph.D. A very young Jim Crossfield in those days was, like me, down there working in that two-year associate degree program at Fayetteville. And then from there I got my Ph.D., came back to Rolla. About that time, my parents wanted to sell the family surveying business. I bought it, and so for many years have owned and operated the family survey, surveying and mapping company here in Rolla.
How big is the presence of the USGS facility in Rolla?
Yes, that's correct. They're right down the street. It used to be the Mid-Continent Map Center. Oh, I don't know what it's called now, but of course the mapping portion of the USGS is small compared to their other endeavors out here at Rolla. But yes, the Mid-Continent Map Center is right down the street. And Rolla is a somewhat unusual place. The Bureau of Mines had a research center here for many years. The U.S. Forest Service, the Missouri headquarters for Mark Twain Forest, is here in Rolla. The Missouri Land Survey, now by a different name, but Bob Myers, for the older listeners, Bob Myers, the longtime state surveyor who built up the state survey, Missouri State Survey program, the Missouri Land Survey is still housed here in Rolla. So
yeah, I was going to ask you about Bob. He was very, very active, and of course the state association was pretty active with us over time.
Yes. Yes, Bob is still with us. Of course, long retired, lives in St. Louis now, but Bob is doing well. And really, the land survey program here became somewhat a model for other states to emulate. And like some other state agencies and organizations, is smaller compared to those days. But yes, the land survey program is still very active here. And the other claim to fame, or as I'm on the seminar circuit and I say I'm from Rolla, Missouri, I always add that Fort Leonard Wood is just down the road, 20 miles or so, down old Route 66, today I-44. But Fort Leonard Wood is just down the road, and Of course, there was a lot of engineering and surveying activities. The Army Engineering School, of course, is there today, as it was many years ago. And I always run across surveyors who remember the days where it was either too hot or too cold in the Army doing engineering or surveying-related work at Fort Leonard Wood.
Yeah, speaking of Fort Leonard Wood, you may not know that through our Certified Survey Technician Program, we just signed an agreement with the military that they are going to use our CST program to as an evaluation tool in that engineering technicians school they have down there.
Oh, that's fabulous.
And then once the soldiers get past that level and go other places, we're looking at bringing in probably levels 2 and 3 as well. But everybody that's coming through the school, the way I understand it, is going to really take part in our level 1. So we're really, really proud of that fact that they were interested in using our program.
These days, as we try to attract, you know, the young, aggressive, smart, responsible, educated youngsters, or not youngsters, but young men and women to our profession, it seems to me a real good source for those would be our veterans. Like down here at Fort Leonard Wood, as they get out of the military, you know, they've had 3, 4, 5 years in engineering related, perhaps engineering tech, or even more specifically surveying. They're veterans. It seems like a real good place for our profession to recruit new folks into.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. And my experience in working with vets, wherever I've worked with them as before, is that they're really good people to work with, and they're great employees.
Yeah, and they've had, you know, they have such a background, that such a great background compared to someone perhaps, you know, right out of high school that's a little tentative on what they want to do. I mean, they just don't have the life experience that a veteran has, and I think that life experience to an employer would be quite valuable. And they'd be highly trainable. I mean, they've been trained in the military. They'd be highly trainable in our area as well.
Yeah, one of my favorite people in the world is about my mom's age. He's still alive. My mom isn't, but he joined the Navy in 1943 at 17 years old and was on some of the original underwater demolition teams, which eventually became the SEALs. And he came to work with me in surveying. I've known him now for close to 40 years, just a fabulous individual. Well, I see we're about to the first break here in another 8 or 10 seconds, so let's go take that break, and we'll come back shortly and pick up with our discussion.
Attention surveyors. Are you aware that that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Quick Stakes is your answer to staking. Lightweight, easy to ride on, easy to use, easy to find, and won't break your back carrying them like the old-fashioned wooden stakes. Have you tried a sample? If not, get a pen and paper and write down this number, 800-438-0387, or go to quickstake.com, that's quickstake.com, and order your samples. Ask your surveying supply dealer for Quick Stakes today.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of 2 instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on 2 locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back with Dick Elgin today, and talking about surveying in general here during our first session and some of his history. And we can continue to talk about history a bit more, or we can go ahead and start getting into some of the specifics of your collection.
Sure. I'd be happy to. One other, all just kind of anecdotal piece. Some of your older viewers may recognize me as being one of the co-developers of the old Astro products with Dave Knowles and Joe Senny. We produced the Astro ROM and Astro Disk, the old HP41 extension module, and also wrote the Leets and now the Sokia Ephemeris, but which is also out of print, of course. So while we're being nostalgic here and talking about the old days, David and Joe and I had a nice hand, along with others, Ben Buckner, for example, along with others who worked on celestial observations in those days, of course, now pretty well supplanted, and appropriately so, by GPS. But there was, of course, a wide application for celestial observations in the 80s and 90s, and that's, we worked on that back in those days. So.
Yeah, I was just attending the West Virginia Surveyors Conference last week and, of course, had conversations with people about Henry Seip.
Don't know
how well you knew him, but...
Oh, yeah.
He was really an interesting fellow. We used to sit beside each other in NSPS Board of Governors meetings, he representing West Virginia and me, Virginia. And, you know, the guy who was his partner in developing the Sumner Site Compass obviously had my same last name, but he was actually from California. I don't know if there's any relation, but I think Henry figured out pretty quickly that there's no way I was smart enough to be kin to that guy, so...
Well, of course, yeah, Henry Seip was another one of those old-timers. He wrote Compass Land Surveying and the book, and it's, well, still the leading book on the subject. And I don't quite remember the publication date. I've got it over here on the shelf someplace. But Henry was advocating compass surveying still, oh, up into the 70s. Is that about right, Kurt?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, further than that, because when I was on the board with him, it was in the 80s. And so, yeah, on up until that. And like you, I have a copy of his book. He actually gave me an autographed copy, which I consider a prized possession.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the instruments in the collection is the Sumner Seip compass, which they had kind of custom designed and manufactured. Let's see, Mr. Sumner, was he with the Forest Service, I believe? Is that correct?
I believe so. I think his first name was Bruce, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. But the Sumner Seip compass, actually, I think that, whatever's the latest incarnation of Warren Knight, I think you can still buy one new, I believe. I did a little research on that sometime back. I think you can still buy essentially a new model of one of those compasses. But that would have been, if we're talking about the early American surveying compasses, well, that would have been the last version of the old standby standard American compass. Would have started in roughly 1700. And so here we are, 250 years later or so, or a little more, a version of that same compass could still be purchased in America.
Yeah, I guess a lot of folks would find it remarkable how long that compass was actually the primary instrument.
Yes, that's correct. A little background on the standard American compass, from roughly 1700 in America, American makers began making this what would kind of be known as a standard American surveyor's compass, a needle 5 inches long in a brass device with arms on it. And of course, the compass sights would be 14 inches or so. But that became pretty much a unique American device. Elsewhere, they had compasses, but they had dividing engines which could divide circles and make more precise instruments. In America, we were still using the compass, and that compass, of course, is a function of magnetic north, and so that compass was used as the backbone of direction finding from 1700. And then that compass went through a few improvements. We went from the plain compass, which did not have a vernier on it, so one could not set off the declination. But the evolution would be from the plain compass to the vernier compass, which would be, roughly 1800 or so. And then the vernier compass was produced, you could find it in W. and L. E. Gurley catalogs up until the 1920s. So for 100 years, the technology essentially did not change. The vernier compass looked like a vernier compass for 100 years. And then there were a couple of other versions of the vernier compass. We graduated to, some did, to the solar compass invented by William Austin Burt in, the 1830s or so. The solar compass got us away from the magnetic needle. It used the sun's position to determine true north. And then the solar compass was used, up probably by the BLM, even by the GLO, and then the BLM. I suspect that there were solar compasses still in use in the 1940s, perhaps. And then, of course, transits and theodolites. But the compass technology went nowhere from in America from 1700 until 1920. So, a couple hundred years. If you can imagine any of our technology today being used a couple hundred years from now, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's not going to be the same technology as we're using today, for sure.
Yeah, it's just astonishing to think how things change so rapidly. My first surveying job was in the mid-60s, and we were still using the transit, of course. But just in a lifetime, seeing what that dramatic change was and to think back to how long that compass was the standard, it's just really amazing to think about.
Yeah. And then, of course, then over on the distance side, we had the chain. And it was, of course, literally a chain. It looked like a chain, smelled like a chain, acted like a chain, must have been a chain with links. Edmund Gunter developed that unit of length, 66 feet long. Chain had 100 links, so it made it a decimal unit. And that chain was manufactured, literally a link chain, of course, up until when technology was such that they could put it into a steel ribbon. And then it became a steel tape, but of course we surveyors even today still call it a chain. But the chain was the early dimension for length.
Being a collector, do you get involved in any chain throwing contests?
Yes, not as good as I used to be, but yes. And it takes an old timer like you or me, Kurt, in order to participate in those things. But yes, it's always a thrill, or it's fun to throw a chain and then hand one to a youngster, a young surveyor, and say, here, take it from the figure eight, of course, that you get when you do it up, and then throw it into a circle. And it's a pretty perplexing problem for them, but of course we old timers make it look easy. It's always fun to play with a person that doesn't know how to do that.
I can still remember the sense of satisfaction the first time I ever figured out how to do it.
Sure. A milestone. You weren't a new guy anymore.
No, that's right. You were kind of a part of the team after that. You're able to do the chain throw. That's true.
Yeah.
We used to do those competitions at the ACSM NSPS conferences, and chain throwing was one of the competitions. And I'm not sure why it was, but it seemed to me that it, more often than not, the winner ended up being from North Carolina for some reason. I'm not really sure what that was all about, but it was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
So with the measurement, a lot of our listeners obviously are going to know a lot of this information, but when you talk about the chain and then the ribbon, the roll chain, I guess, was
sure.
One way
mm-hmm.
to put it. And you look at the use of those things in measurement. And again, the chain itself and then its replacement, I guess, well, some people, I guess, have used it even further. I recall the changes being more probably in the 70s or 80s when the first distance meters seemed to come along.
Yeah, I think that's correct. In our office, my father, of course, bought a Beetle, as most of we kind of rural boundary folks did. Oh, that would have been in the late 60s, I think, early 70s. And then it just graduated from there. But even so, the steel tapes probably started their demise something in the 1970s or so.
Do you happen to have in your collection a 500-foot reel tape?
No, I don't. But I do have a 300-foot Invar steel tape. And, of course, Invar was an alloy such that the coefficient of thermal expansion was near zero. So it would have been a pretty high-class baseline tape. Mm-hmm. And it's 300 feet, and it's on a ribbon. On a reel, and it is Invar.
Yeah, I was working in the mountains in southwestern Virginia early in my career, and we of course had the standard 200 foot one, and we had a 300 foot reel, but we also had a 500 foot, and that thing was not much thicker than the eyeglass piece I'm holding up in front of me here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever saw one of those things, but they were really thin.
Yeah, the 300-footer that I have is very, very thin. But now you surprise me, Kurt. My gosh, there's no 300, there's no 200 feet in either one of the Virginias that's horizontal. How in the world would you be using that? You must have been measuring slope distances or something.
We were. And also, it was really handy if you had a really steep ravine and the tops of each side weren't too far apart, if you could drag it across the bottom and work it up through the tree limbs.
But yeah, well, there were, of course, many, many different taping techniques in those days, both for chains here in Missouri in the original GLO surveys, which would date about 1820 or so. The instructions were that the dimensions were to be recorded in chains, 66 footers. But the device was supposed to be a two-pull. They called it a two-pull chain, so that would be a 33-footer. So the instructions were that you used a chain 33 feet long, but you recorded the dimensions in 66-foot lengths.
And well, that's a good spot for us to take our next break, so let's go ahead and do that. By the way, after we come back after this second break is the time during the show where I'll ask you a question and you'll give me an answer, and then the person that emails that answer in will be the winner. And I'm thinking maybe could we do a question that was somehow related to Invar?
Sure.
I mean, I don't know what the right question to ask is to get the answer to be Invar, because I want the answer to be fairly short.
Okay. So the question would be, what's the steel called which has a low coefficient of thermal expansion that was used in taping?
Okay.
And the answer would be an Invar tape.
Okay.
So somewhere in...
Yeah, when we come back, I'll ask that question right away, and then we'll move on with our discussion.
Okay. But you want me to answer it right then or hold off on the answer?
No, you can answer it right then.
Right then. Okay. Mm-hmm. Another thing I think I want to talk about here just a little bit is the relationship between this dimension, the chain, and an acre.
Okay.
And I've got a little routine here, a little kind of did you know thing I'll go through. So
okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Kurt, I was late in getting back in. I'm sorry, I got caught.
Oh, that's okay. We were just I don't know if we were still running or not.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
Quick Stakes. Does your survey supply dealer have Quick Stakes? If not, demand that they start carrying Quick Stakes. Did you know that Quick Stakes are better for your back than your local chiropractor? Lightweight and easier to use than the old heavy wooden stake. Order a sample today and prove it to yourself. Quick Stakes, your back-friendly stake.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Schonstedt, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com, and thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Back to our third segment today with Dick Elgin. We're talking about survey equipment and other things. And, of course, this is the time of the show where I ask the guest a question, and whatever response the guest gives is the answer we want to get from someone who will send it to quickstakescontest@AmericasWebRadio.com. By email. So, Dick, the question would be, what is the steel called with the low coefficient of expansion for and survey measurement?
Well, let's see. Steel that does not expand appreciably with changes in temperature, and the answer would be INVAR, I-N-V-A-R.
That's the answer we're looking for our contestants today. So thank you very much for helping with that, Dick.
Sure.
We were talking about measurement and change, and you mentioned something about talking about the dimension relationship change in acres. That sounds intriguing.
It's always kind of a interesting little puzzle. You say, well, this dimension called a chain, it's 66 feet, and you think, well, now where did that come from? What could that have to do with anything? And it turns out there's a relationship between the dimension of a chain and the acreage of the acre. And the long and the short of it is that an acre was defined as much land that an oxen team could plow in a day. And the other factor is that an oxen in those days apparently could plow about 660 feet without tiring, which is 660 is a furlong, or an eighth of a mile. And it also turns out that during the day, the oxen, so this oxen would trudge along for a furlong, cutting a furlough, of course, and then, so 660 feet, and it turns out that in the other direction, the oxen, by going back and forth across this field, the other dimension ended up being about 66 feet. So the oxen could plow an area that was 660 feet on one side and 66 feet on the other side. And that defined an acre. So Edmund Gunter, I guess, got out his pencil and paper and did a little scratching around and this and that. And it turns out that, of course, 660 feet, if you divide that, if the dimension is 66 feet per chain, so that would make the one dimension 10 chains. And then the other dimension was 66 feet, which he said, well, okay, let's call that one chain. So the acre has its derivation, so what could an oxen plow? So it turns out, if you do the math, if you take a rectangle and you multiply the length times the width in chains, and then divide by 10, you get the area in acres. So, of course, every good surveyor knows that a section is a mile by a mile. And so that's 80 chains by 80 chains, 80 chains per mile. And so we have the section that's 80 chains by 80 chains. We multiply those together, 6,400, divide by 10, and it turns out that's the area in acres, which is 640. So the long and the short of it is the equation would be length in chains times width in chains divided by 10 equals area in acres. So it was kind of a calculation trick. Of course, these days with modern calculators, we don't worry about that so much. But in the late 1600s, early 1700s, you know, maybe that calculation was not so easily done. So there is that relationship between chains and acres. And Edmund Gunter recognized it or somehow figured it out. Hence, we have this unit that's kind of odd unit, which is 66 feet long. So.
There, I would say there are people who would venture to say that doing that calculation without a handheld calculator today might be a troublesome one as well.
well, that's correct. And now, while you have your scratch paper out there, Kurt, and while our listeners have a scratch paper, here's a little stupid math trick for you. The question is, how many square feet are there in an acre? And, of course, we surveyors know there's 43,560. So here's a little stupid math trick you can do. What you do is, so if you can't remember that it's 43,560, here's the little stupid math trick. So here's what you do. Write down any three numbers that don't repeat themselves and don't have a zero in them. So, like, for example, let's write down 876. Three numbers, no zeros, and they don't repeat. Okay, now the next step, you turn that sequence around. So you write 6, 7, 8. And then you subtract the little one from the big one. And in this case, that yields a number of 189. Now you reverse that set of numbers again, so you write down 891, and you add them up this time. We subtracted them last time, so we add them this time, and that yields 1,089. Now then take that number and multiply times 40, and guess what number you get every time, no matter what three numbers you start with. And the answer is, if you're following along, you end up with 43,560. How's that for a stupid math trick?
That's pretty amazing.
That'd be some surveyor, you know, would try to impress somebody by asking them how many square feet there are in an acre and then have to go through the little stupid math trick. It always works, it turns out. So I'll kind of recap. Write down any three numbers, reverse them and subtract the two, the little one from the big one. Reverse them again, add them up, and multiply times 40, and the resulting number is always the number of square feet in an acre.
Pretty amazing. And we got in trouble recently on these little hand pocket scales we hand out at conferences and all, because when we send to the printers, they had the dimensions of an acre being multiplied out, and the decimal was, I think, 0.709,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is not exactly precise.
Yeah, yeah.
And we got called on it by a surveyor somewhere.
Oh, those picky surveyors. they know how to take the square root of 43,560 and then call you out on it.
That's right.
yep, those picky surveyors. So.
Pretty interesting. So now we were talking about the chain, and we were talking about the compass, of course. And I guess one quick question, as we were talking about determining land areas, what kind of history is there on how land areas were defined before this, before this equation?
Yeah. Well, I think the... I'm not a very good of a math historian, but the traditional forever land area unit in America has always been the acre. Of course, the hectare and metric came along later, but for us, the basic unit has the basic unit's always been the acre in America. But then, of course, the French and Spanish, you know, they have varas and arpents, and the conversion equations are variable, I think, on some of those dimensions, depending on where you are in the U.S. But certainly for the public land survey system, it was the dimensions were always chains, and the acreage was the area was always acreage.
Well, we've had a discussion about, and we can continue that discussion if we'd like, on measurement tools and instruments for observation, pretty much related to defining land area. Does your collection include other things like what am I thinking of here, the plane table and the Alidade?
Yeah.
Any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, the plane table and Alidade, of course, were let's list some of the early American equipment that would be collectible. If we go back far enough, of course, compass and chain, that would be the two standard devices. And then in America, in the about the mid 1830s or so, with the development of a dividing engine, then we moved to transits, where they used the divided circle rather than just a magnetic needle to measure angles. So the progression would go to transits. And then transits, like compasses, had some variations. There were mining instruments. There were solar instruments. And then from there, really a theodolite, and there's kind of a fine difference or definition, a difference between a theodolite and a transit. But then some of the other devices were plane table and Alidade. Of course, they were mapping devices. The old topographic mapper from perhaps the USGS here in Rolla would make the map as they went. They would draw the contours as they went with this plane table and Alidade system, which was pretty good. And then other devices, a Curta calculator. Some of your listeners probably know the old hand crank coffee grinder Curta, which are very collectible these days.
First one I ever used was in the mid-60s, I guess.
Yeah, that'd be about right. They were made in Liechtenstein, of all places, and there's lots of information that it's a big there are lots of collectors of those on the web, and many good sites about Curtas. If you're a Curta fan, there's a Type 1, Type 2, and on eBay you'll be surprised at what some of those prices are. I think the cheapest I've ever seen one recently is $400 or so, and from there, if you have the nice hard leather case that it came with and the instructions in the metal cans, those are the popular ones, they'd be $1,100, $1,200. Wow. Curtas are quite collectible.
Probably should have hung on to the one I had.
The thing about Curtas calculators is they had a wide following. Not just we surveyors used them. Engineers used them. They were in science as well. Sports car folks who did rallies loved the Curta calculators. So they have a wide following. The buyers for those are lots of, you know, a broad spectrum of collectors, not just a narrow group of surveyors.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. Well, I see we've come to pretty close to the end of another segment, and we'll try not to end too quickly this time. But when we come back, we'll be in our last segment, so I don't know if we want to wrap up with what we've talked about and recap, so to speak, or we can go into new areas, whatever suits you best. Very interesting conversation today, though. I'm sure the listeners are loving this. So hang on just 1 minute or two, and we'll be right back.
getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
Quick Stakes is your answer to staking. Lightweight, easy to ride on, easy to use, easy to find, and won't break your back carrying them like the old-fashioned wooden stakes. Have you tried a sample? If not, get a pen and paper and write down this number, 800-438-0387, or go to quickstake.com, that's Q-U-I-K-S-T-A-K-E.com, and order your samples. Ask your surveying supply dealer for Quick Stakes today.
And here's something new from Schonstadt. Did you know that Schonstadt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com. The pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everyone, to our conversation today with Dick Elgin. We were saying at the break that this topic, like most of the other topics we do, we get into them and we start expanding them. And some people claim that I do that for a reason, so I can keep having people back to the show again, and that way I don't have to hunt new guests all the time. But but that's okay with me, because this is one of the things, Dick, that I'm sure you know this because of your experience with collecting and talking to people and all that, but surveyors in particular are just totally fascinated with all the things we're talking about. Well, yeah. Even if they're not collectors.
Yeah, it's our heritage, you know, and knowing, you know, the way that our forefathers, you know, the equipment, the challenges of doing surveying, and it's applicable today because in resurveys, particularly on the public land survey system where I'm most familiar with, but I think also in the colonial states, how we conduct resurveys today or how we weigh evidence today is somewhat a function of knowing, you know, the old cliche is you have to follow in the footsteps of the original surveyor. Well, if you're going to follow in the footsteps of the digital surveyor, part of what you need to know is what equipment did that person have, what were the air sources, and what accuracies might we expect. So if we found monument while maybe a few feet away from the record dimension, you know, today, are we going to accept that monument? Well, part of that accepting a monument is going to be a function of, well, who put it there? What was their equipment that was used? You know, what's the likelihood that that monument is the one that the original surveyor placed? And if the answer is it's high, then we should be using that monument and not setting another one a few feet away, as some folks are prone to do. But a part of that judgment comes in to by knowing what equipment was used in the day. And you kind of have to have to be a good retracement surveyor, you need to have an appreciation for that early equipment.
Oh, I would agree. I say this all the time, so I'm sure listeners get tired of me saying it, but I always say that our modern-day equipment, GPS and what have you, will let us very precisely put stuff in the wrong place.
That's exactly right. One thing we know when we get done, you know, we may know that we have it exactly in the wrong place, and I don't know if we're ahead with that kind of a statement.
That's true. Well, I want to get on and have you talk about some of the early American makers of equipment. Before we go there, we mentioned Alidate and Plain Table earlier. That one's really dear to me because beginning a surveying career back in the mountains in Virginia, used those things for volumes on settling ponds and coal piles and topography and even surveying for explosions in an army ammunition plant when things got blown up, going in and mapping all the devastations so they could rebuild things. So the only thing I didn't like about the plane table was I don't think anybody's ever not either too tall or too short to use it.
Well, if you have a good collapsible leg, Johnson head tripod, of course.
Yep.
That's the key to a good plane table. And of course, the Johnson head, unlike other tripods, the Johnson head was made so you could level the table.
Right, so, that's the kind I used, yeah. And that came in handy on steep mountain slopes.
Sure, yeah. And then the last evolution of the Alidade would be the self-indexing Alidade. K&E made them late in their run, up into in the 70s or so, which made the measurements easier with the self-indexing. So,
yep.
But some of the early American makers... probably the most notable early maker would probably point to David Rittenhouse as being the man. Mr. Rittenhouse was in Philadelphia in all the mid to early 1700s. Probably the early American man of science. He was an astronomer. He was an instrument maker. Contemporary of Ben Franklin. Made surveying equipment, which was used to survey the federal district in Washington. He made a wide variety of equipment as far as surveying equipment. Oh, probably only something in the 6 to 10 actual surveying instruments. He made other devices, but we're talking about compasses. He's probably just a handful of instruments. And really, if you talk about the most rare and most valuable American compass, it would have to be a David Rittenhouse compass. And just to give your listeners some idea so they don't pass up a garage sale with the chance maybe of finding a David Rittenhouse compass, if you had a David Rittenhouse compass in pretty good shape, there's probably some museum out there, you're probably, I would say $200,000, $250,000 would probably not be out of line if you came up with a new one. So that'll give you some idea, but, the probably the most valuable instrument maker out there, David Rittenhouse. Now, you kind of have to watch out because his brother, Benjamin Rittenhouse, was also a maker. And so if you find a Rittenhouse compass and you think, this is the real deal, well, it might be Benjamin, the brother. And Benjamin, the brother, made quite a few instruments, and they're less valuable. But David would be the earliest, most well-known and best American maker. And he was making instruments in the mid to late 1700s. Another family of very prominent makers they're known as the six Quaker clockmakers. I'll say that five times real fast. the six Quaker clockmakers, and it turns out one of their descendants in the 1940s wrote a book about the six Quaker clockmakers, and it begins with a man named Abel Cotty, who came to Philadelphia. Mr. Cotty was there in the real early 1700s or so. He's credited with making the first clock in America. And then his apprentice ended up marrying his daughter, and that would be Benjamin Chanley. And then Benjamin Chanley Sr. had four sons, and they were all makers as well. So there's Benjamin Jr., Goldsmith, Ellis, and Isaac. And those compasses are very, very rare. They're very ornate. They're just a great craftsmanship, just unbelievable artisans which made those compass faces, scribed the compass faces, so that the Chanleys were a well-known group. And then the Gurleys, the W&LE Gurley, a little bit later, up in Troy, New York, Gurley Company, Kufel and Esser in New York, of course. And then as the U.S., the frontier moved to the west, St. Louis was quite a hub for makers in the mid-1800s. And then Denver, Ainsworth was in Denver for many years, and then San Francisco with Leitz and a maker named Roach. So there's quite a variety of those early notable American makers.
Well, in our last 5 minutes or so, what advice do you give those seeking to buy or sell?
Yeah, a couple things for sellers. These days, well, and buyers, these days the value of the kind of equipment we're talking about here is less than it was a few years ago. Like most other collectibles, prices are soft. Not a lot of expendable income going out on collectibles. The high-end collectibles and the things we're talking about have not lost their value. The middle has lost some. The bottom end of the equipment, not so valuable anymore. But as a seller, eBay is probably the best place to sell. If you're managing an estate or you need to sell something, eBay is probably the best place to sell. With a buyer that's starting a collection, you can focus on a maker or a St. Louis, a maker of some city, like, for example, St. Louis or so. As with other collectibles, you always want to buy the best of whatever it is that you're going to collect. Will the prices come back? Yeah, I think so. I hope so. I got quite a bit in my basement. I hope the prices come back. But it's the heritage and it's the interest and that really, I think, attracts we surveyors, the historical things that attracts we surveyors to the devices.
Yeah, I would think, and I know I see you lots of different places with displays, and I would think it has some level of rewarding feeling to be able to share this kind of information with the younger generation who, you know, people my age certainly are not experts on this. We have some knowledge of it. But I'm assuming probably the younger generation, you have a chance to talk with them and share information with them they've probably never heard before.
Yeah, that's right. And I think they have an interest in it. They just don't know very much about it. They've not been exposed to it so much. So I think we older folks owe it to the younger folks to help preserve our heritage, to help make them better resurveyors by thinking about some of the accuracies of this older equipment, and really appreciation for what our early surveyors did. What a good job they did with what they had to work with.
Yeah, that's very true. By the way, has the whole eBay thing and that type of thing, has that changed the concept of live auctions very much?
A lot of the live auction houses have gone to eBay-like platforms. You know, the old days of trudging to Boston to go to the Skinner auction house to attend a live auction. These days you can do it just as easily sitting, you know, in front of the fireplace on the computer. So most of the large auction houses now have gone to some kind of a live internet auction system. Perhaps not exactly like eBay, but the auction is being streamed live on the internet, and you can join in there and bid.
Right. Well, in our last minute here, first of all, I want to thank you for being with me today. This is a really interesting topic to talk about, and I hope you'll come back and visit me again. I guess the last question I have is, under that scenario, does that cause pause because you can't actually touch things?
Well, it's kind of the old caveat, you know, let the buyer beware, and that was true 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and still today.
So the fact that you're not touching it isn't foreign necessarily. It's just you still have to be cautious no matter which way you go.
Yeah, that's correct. You'd sure want to know what you're buying and have done a little research on it, or have confidence that you know what the piece is, that it's not a fake, for example. That's not too much of a problem in our area of collecting, but still something you'd want to do your research.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Well, again, thanks for joining me on the show today. It's been great to have you, and we'll find a way to get you back on if you're interested.
I'd be happy to help out, Kurt. I sure would, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Take care.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.